right, it's time for hour number two of the Bible study. I'm Chuck Rafferty. Phones are wide open. Come on in if you like. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our guest is Pastor Alan Shane, pastor at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles. I was going to say Old Town St. Charles. Is that a fair description?
It's pretty close, yeah. We're six blocks from downtown, so Main Street is a very much real. We are part of a little community called Midtown.
Midtown.
Serious preservation folks there that are taking care of houses and buildings that have been around for most of the history of St. Charles.
Busy month for you at Emmanuel St. Charles?
May may be the busiest month of the entire year for us.
More busy than December?
Well, it's a little bit more spread out in December, but you have confirmation and graduation and schools rounding out. And
Mother's Day.
And Mother's Day. Major holiday there. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So significant festivals, Ascension, Pentecost, are all loaded up front this year because of the calendar. So.
Is ministry getting weirder since there are more strange and bizarre things that seem to be happening in the culture? I mean, when you were, compare your memory of what your pastor did when you were a boy, just growing up, eighth grade, maybe facing your own confirmation Sunday, to the way it is today dealing with people who are in seventh and eighth grade. Has it gotten just weird, or am I overstating it?
Well, it depends on the connotation you put with the word weird, because sometimes I take weird as the opposite of normal, and normal is the same as sin. So sometimes weird is our word to talk about people who are really giving in to the love of Christ and doing things that are different from the culture and different from the norm and following him. But in the sense of sin, more infectious, and the inventors of evil you talked about in Romans 1. Remember that wonderful phrase that is not only encouraged in the culture, but it's also accelerated because you can spread it faster. You can not only do sin, you can put it on YouTube and let everybody in the world get an idea about what you did.
Let me give you an example. This is a story from Florida. There's a teacher down there in Florida who's in some trouble. His name is Jim Piculus. According to Jim, he says he made a toothpick disappear and reappear in front of students at the Rush Middle School in Land O'Lakes, Florida. It's according to a local television station down there. He said he later got a call from the supervisor of teachers saying that he had been accused of wizardry. I get a call the middle of the day, he says, from the head of supervisor of substitute teachers. He says, Jim, we have a huge issue. You can't take any more assignments. You need to come in right away. He is a substitute teacher, so he's not there on a regular basis necessary, but he's concerned that he may be out off the roster, if you will, for substitutes that are called in on a regular basis. Because apparently, of course, and I realize that there probably are seven sides of this story, but so the guy made a toothpick disappear and reappear in front of his students. Does that qualify as wizardry, Pastor?
If all he did was make a toothpick appear and disappear, I don't think that's wizardry. I think that would be a magic trick, and magic is sometimes a fun way to get kids' attention. But if there's more to it than that, I sure haven't heard it from what stories I've heard.
Well, let's just assume that what we have here are the facts of the matter, for the sake of discussion. If this guy were to come to you, you were his pastor, and say, can you help me here, what would you say?
Well, I would want to listen to the whole story, of course, as you just said. I would probably want to go to his defense if indeed all he did was a simple little trick, and maybe make a phone call and give some character background to the individual if I knew him well. So that you could put it into context. But I don't know what kind of person calls up and even uses the word wizardry nowadays. I mean, what does that mean, other than that he's doing something that you wouldn't expect a teacher typically to do in the daily task?
Well, and again, here we're speculating for the sake of discussion, but there is a kind of personality, there is a character out there who associates these kinds of things with some kind of irreligious or anti-religious activity, unbiblical, maybe sorcery. You know, the Bible forbids sorcery, Pastor.
Well, if we're talking about dabbling in those kinds of dark arts or black magic kinds of things, or if he's telling a story while he's doing this and suggesting some kind of other forces that are involved, what we would refer to as principalities and powers and the powers of darkness and so on, maybe he's bathing all of this in the kids' minds in the background, and all he's saying is, I do this with a toothpick, but maybe it's the words and the connotations and the what he's cultivating in their heads while he's doing that is the objectionable part. And then he'd get his finger slapped, and rightly so.
Here's another question on another subject. You have confirmation coming up at Emmanuel?
Yes, we do. A week from Sunday.
And how many kids are you going to confirm?
We'll have about 42.
42 eighth graders?
Yes.
You, I assume, know them anywhere from pretty well to extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
How long does it take to begin and complete the confirmation instruction at Emmanuel?
Well, confirmation for people who are not in Christian Day School is about a two-year process. Hopefully they've been in Sunday School before that as they move into that. And then in Christian Day School, we're teaching religion every day, plus chapel services once a week. So those kids have a real solid foundation even before the pastors and the DCEs move in for the eighth grade year and have the intense classes 3 or 4 days a week.
Now, do you do the do you have the tradition where you put the kids in, like, white robes, put a carnation on them, maybe something like that, or flower?
Typically, yes.
I mean, they couldn't be more scrubby dutched up usually on confirmation Sunday. They're made to look about as good as they can look, are they not?
Well, part of that is the picture traditions of the families, because it is a special day, and part of that white robe is a continuation of the baptism theme. Remember, we talk about some congregations do it. We don't particularly do it because a lot of families still have the baptismal gowns. I'm not fond of the concept of christening gowns because we don't use champagne or break a bottle over any baby's heads. But the image of the righteousness of Christ that's placed over the child, and then the confirmation, we connect with baptism in a significant way, what the promises were made for the sponsors, now those children make for themselves and affirm the faith that was granted to them in holy baptism. So I kind of like the white robe thing. But, yeah, they go to a lot of effort. That's a graduation celebration for us. I mean, we have a confirmation graduation banquet. Then confirmation is the 18th and graduation is the 25th. So those kids get some things. Some of them, the parents, we don't encourage a bit, but some of the parents will have their daughters taken out for the picture day and have a day at the beauty parlor before they show up for pictures that
Scrubby
night.
Scrubby Dutch.
You betcha.
So there are some people who are listening to us right now who have just been through this rite or are anticipating it, maybe even Emmanuel St. Charles. They're excited about it. 13, 14 years ago, they brought a child into the world, and they have nurtured that child to this day when they will stand before God and his people and confess their faith in the one true God. It's an exciting time.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people who are listening to us who have this memory, but it's 4, 5, 6, 8 years ago. And that scrubby-dutched eighth grader didn't do so well after getting into high school or leaving for college. And in some cases, life got very complicated and even in some ways dirty. And thinking about confirmation and all the joy that was associated with that has kind of gone away and turned into what happened, what went wrong. I have a story here from Rohnert Park, California. A Rohnert Park teen is recovering at home after drinking what medical professionals say could have been a lethal amount of alcohol. Rohnert Park police say the 15-year-old girl, so she'd be 1, maybe 2 years after what would ordinarily be confirmation age, Rohnert Park police say the 15-year-old girl's blood alcohol content was 0.578, seven times the level for drunken driving when she was hospitalized over the weekend. A police spokesman says after being taken by ambulance to a hospital Friday night, doctors feared she would not live through the night. Police say the girl had been at a party at a home with a group of friends, no adults present. Investigators are still piecing together what happened that night and trying to determine if there was any criminal wrongdoing. The name of the girl has not been released. And my question to you is, as you look into the eyes of those 42 children, whom you will confirm a week from Sunday, there's, I think, a reasonably decent chance that one of them is going to follow a path that will look something like this. Maybe not to this extreme, 0.578, but a destructive path. Does that weigh on you, Pastor, as you send these kids on now into high school and having completed their confirmation experience?
It's a major reality for us all through the confirmation year, and of course we don't just introduce that issue on that day, although there's often an emphasis that this is not a graduation from the scriptures or from worship or from spiritual faith in their life. We know that...
Are you able to communicate that message? Because I think that the overwhelming perception that this is the end of something, not the beginning of something, is going to stick with these kids. Finally, we're done with confirmation.
Well, I think there's a sense of that, and the fact that many of those kids that are going to be confirmed have been at Emmanuel since they were in preschool or kindergarten, that they see it as a significant chapter ending, and the next year will be a new chapter. So there is a sense of concluding something, and often adults have the same sense of, you know, we're gonna go celebrate. Gosh, we got through an entire week. We have to go to Chevy's or TGI Fridays and celebrate because we survived Monday to Friday. So it's natural that they would have a sense of completion. This is something to. There's been some work involved in here. Then we're rejoicing that part is over and we've completed it. There's academic aspects of being in eighth grade religion too. So there's a sense of that. But the issue that you're talking about is something we deal with all the way through the middle school experience as we're getting them ready for confirmation. When we deal with the commandments, we talk about the realities of what human sin can do. We're very upfront about the dangers. When you talk fourth, fifth, and sixth commandment issues about the dangers that we, in our society, it's not unusual to have kids that are in 7th and 8th grade that are already addicted to drugs or alcohol or sex, or have completely unwholesome approaches to
that. Do you realize how shocking that statement is 30 years ago, 25 years ago maybe?
Well, we perhaps lived a little bit more in denial about it.
It's not unusual to have 7th and 8th graders addicted to drugs, alcohol, or sex. 30 years ago, that would have been unusual. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but it would have been unusual.
Well, even 15 years ago when we were talking about STDs in junior high students, you know, most people were living in denial and saying, well, that can't happen here. That, you know, that may happen someplace, maybe out in on a coastal state or something of that, but it doesn't happen here. You know, it's like we pretend that 13-year-old children can't get pregnant or something of that nature. And so... But I think our general educational context, and specifically in religion classes, is that we need to be upfront and honest with the kids about that, so that when we do sex education classes and put them in the context of our body as the temple of Christ and the temptations that are going to be out there and the mentality of the culture that completely separates my body from respect for God and honoring the precious gift that God has given. It's my body. It's not, it doesn't belong to anybody but me, and I can do with it as I please kind of stuff. Or the, you know, the peer pressure issues that they deal with at that point too.
Well, we're in a cultural time where we adults are dressing up our daughters earlier and earlier, sexualizing them, making them look like young women. The Molly Cyrus flap right now is all about that. She's been sexualized. She's only 15. She's the same age as this girl, this unnamed girl here from Roman Park, California. And they have cell phones, and they're coming and going. And we parents, the one thing we don't want to be guilty of is being dictatorial or inflexible or super tough. You know, Jimmy and Janie's parents aren't like this. They let them do these kinds of things, and so we let them do it. And then sooner or later, somehow, you're underage, not old enough to vote, just barely out of confirmation, daughter winds up at a party where she can get almost 6/10 of blood alcohol, and there aren't any adults present. What's going on?
Yeah, well, you wonder where the adults are, or what's kind of going on in a situation. You know, I've heard of those kinds of parties that have been associated with high schools, where people will find out that a parent's not going to be home, and then an entire class will simply descend on that home, bring their alcohol or drink the alcohol that's in the home, and turn a what could have been a very nice evening for kids into a travesty with somebody's either alcohol abuse or drug abuse, or they get into a car and do something stupid, or vandalism issues, or all kinds of things that can come out of that. And you wonder where it all comes from. Certainly some of it is parental fatigue. They're worn down by doing so many other things and trying to be parents at the same time. And don't you recall being a teenager and kind of wearing your parents down at times when
sure.
you wanted something? You know, I could ask for something 48 or 65 times.
But I don't even know
times.
Anybody who got to 0.578 at age 15 in drug alcohol, blood content.
No, and the ready availability of it, and the, you know, in some senses our society.
They thought this girl was going to die. You know, we're not talking about embarrassing the family necessarily here, or stumbling in a little bit after curfew. She almost died.
One of the things my son told me a number of years ago was what he experienced in many of the young people was a despair, a hopelessness about the future. So that if you tell them that they're taking a risk that might damage their life, their response is, well, so what? I don't know that I want to live anyway if I'm going to have to live in the kind of world in which we live, in which I don't have much expectation of being able to succeed. I don't have much expectation of having a solid life, a valuable life, a life that is going to be a pleasing life, satisfying, contribute something to society. There's a widespread...
Fulfilling.
Yeah, that's a very good word. Thank you. There is a widespread depression level of people that says... There isn't that much to look forward to in adult life, particularly, you know, they look at me and say, Dad, I really don't want to work 60 to 70 hours a week to eke by and to barely survive. Why would I make a huge effort to do that? So they go for the now. And if something is said to them, you wait till you're 21 and you're a little bit more mature and you can make better decisions about the use of alcohol, they look like, well, why would I want to wait? I want to do that now. And so if there's a risk, well, there's some medical technology that'll rescue me or fix me, or I'll take a pill and get over it or something of that nature.
So if I were a member of Emmanuel St. Charles, so you were my pastor, and it came to your attention that some kids in the parish, kids that you knew, they had gone through your confirmation class, got in a little trouble. Well, what kind of trouble? Well... They found out that Chuck wasn't home, and they descended on his house, and there was a lot of drinking there. And, boy, we were lucky nothing terrible happened. But it was not right. Are you going to give me a phone call? Are you going to get involved in that?
In our setting, it's more likely that the people who have been concentrating in youth ministry are going to make that happen. We have, we're blessed to have two outstanding DCEs who have been working tirelessly to build relationships with these kids. And with that stronger relationship, they're more likely to be the ones that are going to be already there with an understanding, with a sensitivity, with an ability to separate reality from fiction, and to speak to them and to be heard, because the relationship's been pretty well established. You know, would I not have that advantage of having those two people on staff or teachers that have known these kids and lived with them in far more depth than I am able to do, then that's a pastoral role, to be there with the kids, to be there with the parents, and so on.
So even though maybe as far as Emmanuel St. Charles is concerned, my most natural relationship is with you. You going to send your DCE out to talk to me?
If you talking to the adults or the kids?
I'm talking about the adults. Talking about, look, this was my house, and somehow I managed my affairs in such a way that my house got taken over, and some serious stuff happened there. Now, I am responsible for my house, am I not? I can't look at you and say, well, I'm pastor. I wasn't there. It's not my fault. You're not going to let me off that easy, are you?
Well, if they're open to a pastor being involved in that issue, then we're going to try to be there. Unfortunately,
what if they're not open?
Well, that's I think a reality that's happening, in the sense that if parents are of a nature that they leave their house vulnerable or don't protect against that kind of a thing, or don't have something in place to keep that from happening, they're also not as likely to, I think, to take seriously the issue. You know, they're just say, well, kids are kids. They do things like that. It's going to happen. And you know, some kids going to be stupid, but by and large, most kids won't do that. And they'll dismiss it. You know, yeah. And I think that's part of the issue that
and
a lot of people
years
have
ago,
minimized.
You know, I can hear that. But now, this girl almost died. And and you and I both know that this is a story that's out today. But this is not rare.
No, it's not.
This is going on.
Well, it's that age-old discussion that you've probably been a part of, and I'm not sure you've done it here or not, but about parents, whether they buy the alcohol for their kids and put them in a safe place to, quote, drink instead of going out and doing it behind their backs. So they create a sanctuary.
Yeah,
a house,
so if I do that and you're my pastor, you're going to get in touch
with whatever.
Me? Oh, then that couldn't happen here, because we have our son bringing his friends over, and we take all their keys so that they can't drive home, and then we let them drink all they want.
Amen.
You're going to come visit me if I'm the adult, and that comes to your attention?
Well, I think the more likely reality is if they're that determined that they're going to do that, they're not going to be influenced a great deal by a pastor who has other concerns. You know, so if we would like to have a way to talk to them about that, but many times the door is kind of closed. You know,
if I'm having young people over at my house and some of them are underage, and I'm providing a sanctuary so that they can drink and not get picked up by the police, is that a sin if I do that?
I think you've crossed the line. Now, a similar discussion on the news this morning. Fox was carrying a story about whether it was okay for underage kids to drink when they go on a trip to a country where the drinking age is legal. And can they do that?
Save that answer for us. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. You're listening to our Ask the Pastor Bible Study. Pastor Alan Shade with us here today. How about you? What do you think about this drinking phenomenon? We'll be right back.
I'm Diane Summers.
And I'm Steve Siegel.
On the next afternoon show on AM 850 KFUO,
we'll have Stephen Nichols, author of Jesus Made in America, a cultural history from the Puritans to the Passion of the Christ. He'll fill us in on how American notions of Jesus were shaped by the culture, often with unfortunate results.
Pastor Scott Seidler from Concordia Lutheran Church in Kirkwood talks about kids and money.
On the next afternoon show, 3 to 6 on AM 850 KFUO.
Hi, this is Chuck Rathert with an update on our most recent Share-a-thon. As we continue to tabulate the Share-a-thon mail response, we're pleased to report that we have reached our 2008 goal. Current pledges total over $101,000. If you haven't yet responded to Share-a-thon 2008, it's not too late to mail in your gift. If you helped us to surpass our goal, thank you. from the bottom of my heart for your generous support.
Fish give us new hope for repairing spinal cord injuries. Learn about it next on today's Creation Moments. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
Modern medicine has increasingly returned to study how nature accomplishes medical miracles to bring the benefits of what they learn to mankind. Man has dreamed for thousands of years of being able to restore a severed spinal cord. Once the nerves running inside our backbones are severed, we permanently lose the use of our limbs below the point of damage. Medical researchers have learned that the black ghost knifefish, native to South America, is actually able to regrow its backbone if it is severed. The black ghost knifefish can even regrow the spinal cord within the backbone and the supporting muscle structure. What's more, scientists have identified the layer of cells responsible for this regrowth. The best news is that human beings also have the same layer of cells. Unfortunately, the layer becomes dormant by the time we reach adulthood. Researchers are currently trying to learn how that layer of cells, with its wonderful abilities, might be stimulated back into action if needed to repair a severed spinal cord. This shows us that when we Christians talk about the clear evidence of God's intelligence in the universe, we are not engaging in wishful thinking. Even our best medical researchers recognize the intelligence with which the creation is made, and they desire to learn from that intelligence.
For more information, visit us online at creationmoments.com. You'll find both written and audio transcripts, creation-focused articles and Bible studies, and many other resources, all at creationmoments.com. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Wallace, host of Woman to Woman. What happens when life as you know it is turned completely upside down? We'll learn how one family is coping with the shocking reality that their son, who had everything going for him but made a poor choice, will spend the rest of his life in prison. There's a way to find a new normal when life leads you down a path you didn't expect. Join me and my guest, Carol Kent, Woman to Woman, Talk You Can Trust.
Saturday mornings at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Now showing at the Missouri Botanical Garden, colorful, playful mosaic sculptures by Nikki through October 31st. See 39 mosaic and painted sculptures gathered from around the world placed throughout the lovely 79-acre botanical garden. And get this, the garden will offer audio commentary of the exhibition by cell phone or MP3 player available for download at mobot.org. See the works of Nikki at the Missouri Botanical Garden now through October 31st.
You listen to the Bible study, and I'm interested in what you listeners have to say, what you think about this phenomenon that we're dealing with, where the culture, you know, I'm just going to say it this way, the culture in some ways is just out to consume our children, to destroy our children. Drug dealers want to addict your children. Pornographers want to addict your children. Drinking establishments want to addict your children. And in some cases, they are succeeding wildly. And our children are at risk. So we've been having a conversation here with Pastor Alan Shade, who is getting ready to confirm 42 bright-eyed wonderful children at Emmanuel St. Charles in about a week and a half, and how that weighs on him as a pastor, and maybe how it weighs on you as a parent or a grandparent. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So you were saying before the break that you were watching a story on Fox. Reset that for me.
Fox was raising the issue of a school trip. Kids who are not able by age to drink here at home or in a foreign country where drinking, the age for drinking is considerably lower. So is it the purview of the school to allow those kids to drink in a country where now it's legal, but they're not, their parents are not there with them, and so they're working with chaperones and so on.
What was the consensus?
There wasn't a consensus.
What was your opinion?
My opinion would be that...
Say it's your son who's going to France on a school tour.
If it was my son, I would not give permission to the school to allow him to break laws that are laws for him at home. So the rules from home would be the rules when he goes abroad, that he would not step outside of that boundary. That would be my preference.
But you would apply that from your perspective individually. That's your rule for your child. Would you stop short of encouraging the school administration to apply this universally across the board for all students who are on the particular tour that your son or daughter is participating in?
I would prefer that, just so that the kids are not set up, you know, by their friends to have the extra peer pressure and the games that people play on that way. But again, that is an area of sensitivity that really is a family and parent decision. It's not my purview to impose my will on others in that. But you know, I just don't think it's a good situation, and for the well-being of the kids. If you grew up in a culture, and there are those who have always said, if you grow up in a culture where wine or beer in moderation is a part of the family meal, you know, if kids in France are growing up and they watch mom have or dad have a glass of wine at a meal, and they share in that a little bit from your early ages on and see it in a proper context, then that may form some very good values where they don't see it as something that is to be striven for, or you go for the kick, or you go for the abuse of it, sort of thing. So,
well, it gets worse. Here's a story out of San Diego. See, I'm looking at these all in the context of those 42 scrubby-dutched confirmands that you're going to be dealing with a week and a half from now. Here's a story out of San Diego. San Diego State University has suspended 6 fraternities after a sweeping drug investigation that landed members of 3 fraternities in jail on suspicion of openly dealing drugs on campus. The probe, prompted by the death a year ago of a freshman sorority member from a cocaine overdose, led to the arrests of 96 people, 75 of them San Diego State students. A second drug death occurred while the investigation went on. 29 people were arrested early Tuesday in raids at 9 locations, including the Theta Chi fraternity, where agents found cocaine, ecstasy, and 3 guns. 18 of them were wanted on warrants for selling to undercover agents. You know any kids who are getting ready to go to college this fall?
Yeah, we got a graduating class at Lutheran High in St. Charles as well.
Are you holding your breath?
I am aware, from having had my kids go through college, university-type settings, that there is abuse, and there's often accelerated abuse, and there are a lot of freshmen students who lose their way. You know, their first year out there, they're away from parents, and they're living their freedom, and they seem to have lost all common sense, and sometimes the fraternity and sorority settings make that even worse than the temptation already is. So if I had that setting, I'd say throw the book at them, you know, because it isn't as though these kids haven't been taught about the dangers and the risks and the damage that can be done with drug and alcohol abuse. I mean, they've been saturated with that since Sesame Street. So when they get to that setting and they make stupid choices, it's still a stupid choice. And when they involve other people in it, That's a criminal offense, and they ought to throw the book at them.
We seem to have come so far from getting in trouble for smoking in the restroom to, in this case, San Diego State University, 2 people dead, yeah. 96 people arrested, 75 of them students. And, you know, it's not a Marlboro. It's cocaine and ecstasy.
Well, that's part of the issue, isn't it?
Are you seeing any alarm? I mean, as you survey St. Charles, or I don't know, your sphere of influence and activity, Emmanuel St. Charles, do you see any alarm on the part of people?
Well, there's a wide set of reactions that way, and so I try not to overgeneralize. In the one sense, anybody that is not aware that the world is getting increasingly sinful and those kinds of things are building and increasing geometrically, not just simple addition, but blowing into huge and huge proportions. If you don't realize that, I don't know what planet you've been on, but you're not on this earth. Then there is an alarmist attitude that goes around and stirs up trouble on one issue or another, and then they wear themselves out, and they don't have enough for the long sustained run that to just teach patiently and encourage and stay on top of the situations. And there, of course, is the street smarts of the kids. So if you are a school administrator or a school teacher and you've got 120 incidents a day, you have to pick the worst cases and deal with those in the strongest possible way. But kids will know they can push the envelope. If there's 120 things happen, then there's no way the teachers or administrators or the faculty can stay on top of that. So, you know, the mob mentality pervades, and I'm sure in a lot of universities they'll figure out, well, they'll get all upset about this, and then we'll calm down for a couple of weeks, and then we'll go back to situation normal, because they'll have had their pictures in the paper being serious about monitoring this issue, and then the other things will come up, and they'll go back to situation normal, and we'll go back to selling drugs, and there'll be lots of young people that want to buy drugs and buy alcohol and do stupid things. So, you know, there's so many different kinds of reactions to get an ordered, a steady, a principled approach to it that gets into kids' heads and talks to them in practical, down-to-earth, real terms, and that comes across in an authentic way. You know, the kids can hear when somebody's just preaching at them to be preaching at them. They can tell when somebody genuinely cares. And even if they're going to resist, because it's our nature to resist everything, even if that's true, when you do it from a caring, authentic way, and they can experience that you actually are concerned about their well-being, some of that stuff will stick. Will it stick with everybody? No. But it still makes a difference. That's why good parenting still is an effective way to drug-proof kids. That's still why teachers have the kind of influence they have over kids. They may not like the fact that you had to do homework, or they may not like the fact that they made them follow certain rules, but if they have that character in a teacher, it has an ongoing influence, and that's why kids come back and say, this person, this teacher made the biggest difference in my life, this coach made the difference in my life, this youth director made the biggest difference in my life, and they become role models for them. So there's an awful lot of that good stuff going on, and it's the extremes that are dysfunctional.
In your experience, do you think that parental naivete is a problem, even a serious problem? So you've got a mom and a dad who, as far as you can tell, love each other, are devoted to one another. Their children have gone through Emmanuel Lutheran School. They've gone on to Lutheran High School in St. Charles. As far as you can tell, everybody's done everything right. Kids have been in Sunday school. And then as those kids go on in life, whether it's into high school or into college or whatever, there's a certain sense of, hey, we've done it right. We raised our kids the proper way. They were in church every Sunday. So they ought to be shielded from San Diego State University and Rohnert Park, California. Our kids should be shielded from that stuff. They should be safe. Is there a naivete?
I don't think you can make it a black and white kind of thing. Our experience is that if parents have done a good job, as good a job as they can do parenting, and they've done the basics of getting them into a good Christian setting, and they've set an example for them, and they've talked with their kids, and they've kept the dialogue options open, and they've tried to live that and model that, that the vast majority are going to have great success with that. Are they going to have exceptions to that? Sure. You know, you talk with church workers, you know, the teachers' kids and preachers' kids and DCE's kids, they sometimes are some of the worst in the lot, or things don't turn out as well as you would like to have had it. But if you look at it over the years, it does make a significant difference. I'm very pleased, very grateful to be a part of a congregation that operates a Christian school, and to know that, okay, we're going to have our kids that come out of there that are going to make it on the front page of the paper, or they're going to do stupid things, or there's going to be an occasional funeral of a young kid that we wouldn't want to have had. But for a lot of people, it works. It's not a mathematical formula. I can't guarantee you 93.6% of the kids that graduate from Emmanuel are going to be perfect kids. But they're going to get the pieces that they need and the foundation that they need and experience the love of Christ in a caring context that does make a difference in a lot of lives. Is it a hard-clad guarantee? I can't do that.
Is it an overstatement to say that a generation ago, the culture was ordered in such a way as to more or less support that context that you just described, that loving context in which you get the pieces that you need in order to have a productive and godly life? Would it be an overstatement to say that that coin has been turned over and the culture is now arranged in such a way as to resist and impede everything you're trying to do at Emmanuel St. Charles?
Maybe an oversimplification. I think the temptations to the previous generations were there. But if you add up the materialism, the instant communication, the impact of the media, and the arrival of postmodernism, where values are sort of tossed up in the air and reduced to, well, I don't feel like doing that kind of stuff. If you add all of those in, that's a powerful impact that has come to this generation. I feel sorry for the kids growing up in our time with the stuff that they have to deal with that my generation probably had a much safer environment in which to grow.
Now you put your finger right on the deal, because that's how we began this conversation. And I know you don't mean to say that you feel sorry for your 42 confirmands. I know that you're going to have a joyous confirmation Sunday there at Emmanuel St. Charles, and it will be a wonderful day in Jesus. But that part of Alan Shea that feels sorry for kids who are growing up in this current cultural environment, what goes on in Alan Shea's heart as he looks upon those 42?
One of the things, we've kind of pushed this in the discussion towards the kids, but I think as I look back on most of the sermons that I preached on Confirmation Day, it's been more aimed at the parents.
Why?
Well, I've had the kids. You know, I've been working with those kids for 9 months and talked to them pretty intimately and pretty openly through all the time that we've been together in confirmation. But I often haven't had the parents on more than a little bit here and there. And some of those parents, you know, they dropped the kid off at confirmation and went to the casino. While we're trying to teach them Christian values, they're over at the casino trying to get some money that belonged to somebody else that they have no right to have, you know. So my concern is that a lot of parents abandon their kids and saying, well, we gave you 8 years at Emmanuel, or we gave you all this confirmation instruction. Our religious responsibility of training you is over. We don't have to do it anymore. And they drop them. They just kind of throw the kids and say, okay, it's up to you now. You've got enough background. You can make good choices, as though their responsibility to continue the support, the encouragement, the caring, is their job's done. And so, you know, these aren't the sponsors of the kids. These are the parents of the kids. They're going to be parents until Christ takes them into heaven. So we actually sometimes, I shouldn't speak for my partners, but I actually sometimes have more concern about what choices now parents are going to make going forward from this, based on the foundation we've tried to put into the hearts and attitudes of the kids.
Based on your many years of experience as a pastor and having watched the devolution of the culture from at least being neutral, at least, if not supportive, to hostile and destructive in some ways, what kind of advice would you give to a young man? Just got a call a couple weeks ago here at Concordia Seminary, or Concordia Fort Wayne is going to be entering the ministry and is going to be arriving right in the middle of what we're describing here. You've had a chance to work your way through this over many years, but he's going to be hitting it cold. What advice would you give him?
Well, I don't know if they're hitting it cold, Chuck. First of all, they're getting the right theology, the biblical framework that they're going to use to make those decisions. They've grown up in this culture, you know, in some senses.
Maybe they're better at
it. I'm a spectator, and they've lived in it. They've done the video games. They've hung out with the kids in high school and college that were on the edge or going in those directions. They've lived with all of the media impact and stuff, and they still have that firm conviction from the Lord that He has called them to speak to this generation and to minister to them. So I'm not going to sell them short as though they're less prepared. Some ways I think maybe they're better prepared than I am because I'm a little bit from a previous generation that doesn't always fully understand what it's gone through. So in that sense, yeah, if I do get a chance to influence them, I'll do the same things that we've been doing the last 15 years, and that is to talk about, make sure the kids learn the word, because there, regardless of where you go, there's an enormous ignorance about Scripture. You know, kids, for whatever's going on in their life, they are not learning the great stories of Scripture, so they often are still kind of shallow at that. And secondly, the relational side of ministry to kids is enormous. You know, the time when my father could walk into confirmation class and start lecturing at 9:01 and quit lecturing at 9:45 and not worry about building relationship with the kids, that's over. These kids have an enormous need for that dimension of it, and that's going to continue.
Do you have, maybe this is too personal, sorry, do you have a sense, as you look at the confirmation classes, the eighth graders who pass under your instruction, do you have a sense for, I'm worried about that one. That one's going to be great. That one's going to be fine. But I worry about that one, or I'm troubled by, as I think about the future for that one. Do you have that sense?
I think that's natural that you're going to have that sense about certain students. And it can be a wide variety of reasons. It may be from family background that they're not going to have the support, or it may be that they're unduly sensitive to peer influences and so worried about what others are going to think of them that they have trouble making good choices on their own, you know, those kinds of issues that are going to be there. Some tendencies, you can see sometimes kids that have what look like addictive personalities, and they're going to change addictions, but they're likely to succumb to some kind of addictive issue in their life, or they've opted for a form of rebellion against everything for whatever issue they're trying to work out from their background or their childhood or forces that are going on that I don't fully understand. So there are some that are going to be that way.
Are we the tail on the dog here? Are we just at the mercy of the dog?
And
the dog will wag as it will wag. Is there any way that we can reverse some of these trends so that we don't have to have 15-year-old daughters at 0.5 blood alcohol level, or a dead son or daughter at San Diego State University from a cocaine overdose? Can we head in the opposite direction?
Well, again, these are news stories because they're the exception, not the norm. Okay.
They're a little less exceptional than they were.
They are, but you get more news coverage. You get inundated with that kind
of
stuff.
That make them any less dead or any less drunk.
That's true. But I want to affirm what I said before. An enormous number of parents are doing their very best, and they're doing a good job. They're talking with their kids. They are setting a good example. They're relating with them in Christ Jesus. They're putting things into their background and their foundation that have great experiences. So there are a lot of parents that are doing a very good job, and the kids are coming through. And I just think, to talk about those kinds of kids without also saying, it just blows me away to see the number of kids coming out of our background out there at Emmanuel or Lutheran High or in the St. Charles community. The number of kids who want to be church workers. I've never had any place or never seen so many kids signing up to go to a Concordia and want to be a church worker, and they know they're going to pay $25,000 a year to go to do that, and then get paid $25,000 a year when they get out, and they're still desiring to be pastors and DCs and teachers.
We've got
and
about
music directors.
2 minutes left here. Let's try to sneak in a phone call here. Hi, Chuck. You're on the Bible study.
Hi. I've been listening on and off to your conversation. I think one of the biggest problems is that the kids are learning from the parents to drink and do drugs and all these other things that they shouldn't be doing.
Oh, my. Thank you, Chuck. Pastor, by the way, Pastor Alan Shade is nodding vigorously as he listens to you. Because?
Well, again, right. it's varying in part of the culture, but drinking to excess has become almost the norm. You know, when people go out for an evening or they go to the ball game, you've watched them at the ball game. One beer for the game is not enough. I got to remember when I was a kid watching my dad open a can of beer, one can. He gave a sip to my brother and a sip to me. He gave a part of that can to my mom, and he drank the rest, and that was it. That would be his can of beer for the evening. And, you know, today we often think, well, if I don't have six cans of beer, then I really haven't enjoyed myself. So, you know, the excesses and the abuses, the third and fourth generation of those who are stupid.
Well, maybe that is a reason in itself for some optimism. Adversity sometimes tends to produce resolve in people, and maybe the next generation is tired of having their parents be divorced and their friends killed in car accidents, and maybe they'll have resolve.
There's a lot of that from the Gen X kids that are saying, look at the world that our parents are giving us. We don't want that world, and we're going to make a better choice. So, even the dedication to abstinence, you know, that avoiding sexual contact or STDs or any of that kind of foolishness because they've seen the damage, and they're going to make better choices. Not all of them will succeed, but many of them will.
Well, we pray God's richest blessings on your Confirmation Sunday down there, and I am grateful that you let me pry into your personal pastoral ministry there a little bit. But I'm concerned about these kids, and we adults have some responsibilities that we need to fulfill, I think.
Rightly so.
That is Pastor Alan Shade. He is pastor at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles, and that is our conversation here on our Ask the Pastor program. I'm Chuck Rathit. Thank you so much for being with us here today. We will continue in the book of Romans tomorrow here in our 10 o'clock hour. Pastor David Marth is scheduled to help us with verses 11 through 24, Romans 11. And then in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk to the Executive Director of Lutherans for Life, Dr. James Lamb. Thanks for listening.
Listen to Chuck Rathit and guests Monday through Friday at the same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of The Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.